This is Teddy Troy. Welcome to New Books in Public Policy, a new podcast from the New Books Network. This week, we're going to discuss tabloid medicine, how the internet is being used to hijack medical science for fear and profit. It's by Bob Goldberg, a smart, interesting, and funny guy. And right now, here is the interview. We're here today with Bob Goldberg, or should I say more formally, Robert Goldberg, Ph.D., the author of the new and brilliant book, Tabloid Medicine, How the Internet is Being Used to Hijack Medical Science for Fear and Profit. I have read the book, and it is a fascinating and interesting read. It's worth everybody picking up. It's by Kaplan Publishing, and it really talks about some of the issues that we face in modern medicine today when you have an internet that gives everybody access to equal information, but some information proliferates and makes headlines a little more easily. So with that, I'm going to open things up and have Bob join us on the call, and we'll have a conversation about his new book, Tabloid Medicine.
Thanks for having me, coming on, Bob. And thanks for reading the book.
Well, I couldn't put it down once I started. Can you tell me a little bit about what led you to write the book? And I know you talked a little bit about how your daughter was part of your thinking
process.
Can you talk about that a little, please?
There were two things that prompted me to write the book. First, I had seen the effect of the unfettered dissemination of unscientific information on the internet in my daughter's care. She had read, in fact, it's just not even just one medicine that she took. There were other, every time she goes on the internet, my daughter will come running to me with something saying, well, this causes brain tumors, this causes drug, blood clots. And in that one particular case in the beginning of my book, she really needed to take a medicine that would allow her to stabilize her condition and essentially, go on to live. And I found that it just wasn't the casual or chance encounter of information that over-dramatized the risks of medicines, but rather that there was a systematic effort on the part of people or movements that wanted to, as I say in my book, hijack medical science for their own agenda or for because of their own cultural biases against medical technology. And that as a result, the traditional approach to science, which is sort of somewhat collegial and based upon proving and reproving hypotheses, is being crowded out by these voices and having a direct impact not only on the welfare of someone like my daughter, but millions of people.
Right, the systematic effort is an interesting thing, and by certain people. So you're a little vague on that. So I'd love to hear who are the people behind the systematic effort. But I'd also like you to go a little broader and just start by saying what the book's about, and then who are these people?
Well, the book is really about how the public health has been compromised and harmed by crusaders or whether they're anti-vaccine activists, whether they're public citizen, whether they're just individual scientists that want to make a name for themselves, using the overstatement of or the dramatization of severe dangers, that we're all going to be exposed to radiation, run out and buy the iodine kind of thing if we don't listen to them, and how they've been able to redefine the conversation about risks and benefits with medicine. They would argue that they're trying to improve and keep the public health by making everything safe. But what I show in the book is that whether it's vaccines or antidepressants, diabetes medications, or others, the public health impact has been twofold. First, in the short term, people are sicker, and in some cases, they're dying more often as a result. And secondly, that if these movements ever get control of the process of deciding what we take and when, we're going to be worse off for it. And we're already seeing the effects in reduced innovation at the FDA.
Yeah, no, not everybody in the book is a bad guy, although you do talk about some bad folks, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about the things they do. But you also have some good guys in the book, and one guy whom I just happened to meet, actually, was Paul Offit, who is an expert in vaccines at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And he's suffered more than his share of slings and arrows in his efforts to promote safe vaccines that really are hugely important in terms of saving and extending lives from diseases that were once massive killers and very dangerous.
You know, Paul plugged my – I have a blurb on the back of Paul's book, and he has one on the back of mine. Back scratching.
Uh-oh, back scratching.
Right, I know, conflict of interest. So obviously neither book can be considered reliable. The Paul is a real hero and a real courageous individual who, as you alluded to, you know, he's had death threats on him and his family. So because he has said what should be really, you know, unremarkable, that is, vaccines are highly safe, highly effective, and have been instrumental in reducing the risk of infectious disease around the world. But he was also a victim of what I call tabloid medicine, and that is a group of people latching on to a cause and effect that they, based in this particular case, vaccines causing autism, and using circumstantial evidence and dramatic instances and celebrities to build a case that there was this connection, that secondly, anybody who argued against a connection based upon science was part of a conspiracy to either enrich themselves or enrich the drug companies. We are at a point in time, Tebby, where Jenny McCarthy, who had her claim to fame as a Playboy model, was considered.
Well,
you know what? You're right.
I'm sorry. MTV,
that's almost like getting that is like getting the Nobel Prize. So that's the absolutely. So the what am I saying? So she was getting more coverage and more favorable coverage than Paul Offit. And another part of the book, and Paul's a hero because he plugged away, the media were not heroes. The media played into this narrative. They gave her and the possible link of vaccines and autism equal coverage, equal plausibility. And in the minds of many people, that causality weighed with them as they went into the doctor's office. So as a result, and I just looked at the latest CDC report about immunization rates. I mean, it's striking that immunization rates in 2008 were around 80%. They dropped about 7% among children from 1 year to the next. And they're much lower than they were before the Andrew Wakefield's allegations about vaccines causing autism started. So he has done. Here's the irony, Tavia. That is, as we all know, the way that the media portrays it, you can't trust doctors or researchers who do research for drug companies or medical companies because they obviously have a vested interest in seeing those drugs succeed, and they'll do anything to hide danger that isn't. Andrew Wakefield, who.
Can you explain who Andrew Wakefield is?
Yeah, Andrew Wakefield was a gastroenterologist in Britain who interviewed 12 kids who had autism and asked their parents, gee, did they take the measles vaccine or the MMR or the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine around the same time they had autism? He said they all said yes. That made that that observation made it into the Lancet for some reason.
Which is a big magazine in Britain, the equivalent of the New England Journal of Medicine here. Right?
Wakefield and his colleagues took it a step further. They held a press conference after the publication of The Lancet saying essentially that I wouldn't take the MMR vaccine if I were you, if you wanted to reduce the risk of autism. I would break it up. And from there, immunization rates dropped in England. Those allegations spread to spread to America, of course, and around the world. And we spent a decade fighting over the issue of whether vaccines cause autism.
Now, can you explain why the dropping of immunization rates is such a problem, and not just for the individuals who don't get immunized, but for herd immunity and for immunization compromised
individuals
as well? Sure.
One of the reasons that Wakefield was so successful is that in the absence of any, I'm old enough to remember getting the polio vaccine and having my parents being worried about getting overheated because I might get polio. But I think that was, in fact, my mother still says that today, but that's because.
I think that qualifies as what they call it, bubble mice.
So trust
old wives'
tale. So we live in a time when vaccines have eradicated a lot of these diseases. And what I say in the book also is that the way that we frame risk as individuals, and not just individuals, but as a culture, is initially by taking the absence of anything bad as the state of nature, and therefore anything that happens that bad is a corruption of that state of nature. The reason that herd immunity, the reason that people were able to get away with making these outrageous claims is that we were so well protected. But once you start herd immunity is like a probably not a good term. It's sort of like the fabric of immunity, because once you start pulling at at one strand, it starts undoing. And what happens, for instance, in the case of Marin County, is that kids who are not older kids who are not immunized for whooping cough or measles will give it to their infant siblings. People will get on planes and fly from Switzerland to the United Kingdom to the U.S., to Baltimore to Albuquerque, and infect people without them knowing it.
And this happened with measles those specific
countries.
Yeah, what
happened just recently, it happened a few years ago as well. So, especially in an era when the world is smaller, not immunizing even a handful of people can cause a spike in disease and outbreak, which, of course, is what's happened over the last few years. We've had outbreaks of measles, outbreaks of meningitis, outbreaks of whooping cough that, apart from the economic cost, have horribly scarred children. So the other part, of course.
And these were diseases that were largely eradicated.
Measles should be eradicated. Polio. We're trying to eradicate polio, but if we don't immunize for polio, and one person from India comes over here and with a disease, and there is a significant incidence in India, then a lot of other people are going to be affected, particularly those who have not yet been immunized.
Yeah, you have another chapter, which is really interesting, called Web of Fear, where you talk about how scare tactics work really well on the internet in the current environment. I mean, the internet has a lot. The internet is a tool, right? I'm neutral on the internet, right? Used for good, I'm for it, and if used for bad, I'm against it. Can you talk a little bit about your views of the internet and what the problem is and how?
Sure.
We can
My views of the internet are a little bit skewed because I've done online dating, and that would maybe you can hunt me back when I write my book regarding that particular subject.
That's a real web of fear.
Of course, on the other hand, it's made fantasy baseball much more efficient. And I'm kidding, of course, but it has.
It has. I mean, they're a huge tool.
Sure.
I mean, people know a lot more about baseball or whatever subject they want to know via the internet. On the other hand, sometimes people who have false information.
Well, that's exactly right. And we are more inclined to seize on the vivid, dramatic risk quicker than we are to digest a cause and effect that's established in science. So the idea that for example, you know, in popular culture. I mean, the whole look at Charlie Sheen's a great example. I mean, Charlie Sheen went viral almost literally because of the internet, and who would have you know, it dominated all the searches. So because that's part of, you know, who we are. On the when it comes to science, it's very what used to be back in the you know, the pre-internet days, if you wanted to organize a movement, say the environmental movement, you had to rely upon, you know, the copy machine, phones, going door to door. The transaction costs were pretty high to sort of maintain support in your base. The internet makes it much easier and much cheaper and faster to push a particular view, not only for the immediate purposes of keeping the lights on, but in defining the conflict itself. So as I write in the book, you know, Steve Nissen, who is a physician at the Cleveland Clinic, a cardiologist, did a study. Again, this is you see the part of the pattern. Did a study which showed that a drug for diabetes, a oral drug for diabetes called Avandia, was 42% more likely to cause heart attacks than other medications. And that went online. Went online to the New England Journal of Medicine, and it spread very quickly thereafter. Of course, Nissen using these tactics that Wakefield initially adopted. And
so, when you say study really here, do you mean study?
No, this the other thing is that it's not really a study. It's data mining. I mean, it's all part of a pattern of how you use hijack medical science. Nissen did not do a controlled prospective study of how people fared on Avandia versus other drugs. The government did. The government did two studies and found that Avandia controlled insulin levels and as well as other drugs, and it didn't have any higher cardiac risks than other problems. But what Nissen did is he figured out what trials he should look at that would demonstrate the highest risk of the drug. And, you know, you can do that. That's a legitimate thing to do if you're looking to generate hypotheses for further study. But what he was doing was generating this information to promote himself and headlines. And by the time that spread around, the FDA had another Vioxx on its hands, and it became very difficult to keep that medication on the market.
So has Nissen suffered in any way from promoting this kind of data mining study and harming the people?
No,
who
I mean,
need the
drug? As an aside, you know, I think he had ambitions of becoming the FDA or, you know, running the FDA from his home office or something, but it never, I think you can't be toxic and be a government official, as you know. You have to have a little bit of seichel, which is French for, you know, common sense. But he has not suffered at all. In fact, his own conflicts of interest, which he alleged were part of the reason that Avandia was widely marketed despite the alleged dangers, were never addressed. He has gone on and went on to say things that ADHD drugs cause cardiovascular problems. The media never challenges the science. They'll turn to Nissen and go, well, he said this. And then they'll turn to someone else and say, well, it's a he said, she said. Science is not like that. So he is not. Yeah.
There's good science and bad science.
But as I point out in the book, there's what is beneficial relative to the risk for you. And he never made that distinction. Continues to dramatize dangers of medications at the expense of saying, you know, what only science could allow.
You have a chapter on this subject on the other side, yes, called The Assault on Scientists, where you make the interesting case that that I hadn't really thought of, that there's an explicit goal on the side of the anti-science forces, which is to take real, sure, experts off the table and to prevent them from participating in FDA working groups or FDA panels. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, well, if you don't want to engage, if you're an ideologue or you're and a cultural bias is also an ideological bias, if you believe that anyone that works, speaks for, or endorses products from the pharmaceutical industry in particular, you are illegitimate. And the way that you silence people is by and own the space entirely is by saying, oh, they're conflicted, therefore what they say has no merit, we can't trust them, which is so absurd. As I think I point out in the book, if that was the case, then everything we know about germ theory from Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur would be illegitimate, because Pasteur received funding from the beer and wine industry for his fermentation experiments, which were essential to his development of the theory. And obviously, Pasteur was a crook, right? You know, you can't trust.
Are you telling me that Louis Pasteur took money from industry? Does that mean I shouldn't have pasteurized
well,
milk anymore for my
that,
children?
That have whole milk, absolutely. And Pasteur, by the way, himself had his own beer and wine company, which was even more horrific. Yes, well, outrageous. And then,
outrageous.
And so that's the level to which the discussion goes to. And as a result, you don't. It's the best straw man out there. On the other, as I point out, though, that we should look at the results of the different approaches or the different conclusions or recommendations of the quote-unquote conflicted experts as opposed to those that are raising the accusation. And here again, I point out that those individuals – I didn't put this out in the book, but Public Citizen, for instance, has a book called Worst Pills, Best Pills, which turns out, and they have a website for it as well. They generate millions of dollars a year from coming up with updates about what drugs not to take. And if you go back to several editions of Worst Pills, Best Pills, you know what you find? You find that every diabetes drug except for insulin was considered a do not use drug by Public Citizen.
There's a financial
incentive for them, is if they sell books and they sell subscriptions to their magazines. But they profit by promoting their agenda, and they take it a step further by saying that anyone that disagrees with us is obviously illegitimate because they've done work for industry.
Right, I think that's getting to the point we were talking about earlier, this
right.
goal to take experts off the table. Why does Public Citizen or Center for Science and Public Interest or those type of groups, why do they want to
take
experts off
the table so that they can control the debates or the definition of what is safe and what's not safe, and that allows them to control the amount of innovation that is produced and how often we consume it, which is their goal. I mean, they have a cultural bias against medical innovation.
Could we talk a little bit more about this innovation question? I mean, what's happening with innovation in the life sciences field in America, and what is the impact of your notion of tabloid medicine on that innovation?
The impact is very concrete in a negative sense.
In a negative sense,
look, on the stepping back a bit, it's the effort to come up with better medications or devices for more complex and chronic diseases is hard. It's a difficult and risky undertaking. but it's been made more so by the fact that the Department of Justice now uses conflict of interest to extract about $4 billion from drug companies. The size of settlements, you know, have been in the billions.
How do they do this extraction?
You can, you know, they will take any statement that is, I'll give you the example of, you know, Botox. You know, Botox was approved by the FDA for use, and Botox is a poison. It kills the nerves. But in the controlled, you know, in the controlled formulation, it would allow kids with cerebral palsy to stop having spasms, allow them to eat. So, but there was another interesting off-label use for Botox. It reduced wrinkles, and you know, it made a small fortune for the company, which they you know, reinvested and so on. But especially in Beverly
Hills,
in Beverly
Hills
and Boca Raton. But the what happened with so with respect to Botox, trial attorney said, these off-label uses are illegal because you're making claims that aren't on that the FDA said, and you're you can't market, you can't talk about it. You can't the doctors, companies can't talk about the doctors, and doctors are using it in ways that are probably criminal. I mean, that was the, you know, that's at least the essence of the suits. The Department of Justice has used that model to go after other companies to see with respect to their marketing practices. And I'm sorry.
I suppose you should just step back for one second and explain that off-label uses, while they sound nefarious, are used by doctors all the time based on their experience and scientific knowledge.
Off-label uses are innovative uses in the sense that it'll be approved for Pax, you know, Zoloft or Prozac was initially approved for moderate depression, but doctors saw through their own clinical, you know, through clinical observation that, and through additional research about the molecular basis of these illnesses, that it could affect other parts of the brain or other receptors that affected other diseases like anxiety or eating disorders in a beneficial way. If we had to wait for the FDA to approve every new use, the amount, a lot of people would be suffering, including children with cancer. I mean, most cancer drugs for children are used in an off, quote unquote, off-label fashion. And what has happened is that the conflict of interest in tabloid medicine people have, like you said, equated off-label with dangerous. And that also has had a huge impact on the health of many, you know, many groups in America. And that's also raised the bar for innovation. It takes a lot longer to get a drug through the FDA because they want more studies.
How long on average does it take to get a drug through the FDA?
From the time that you it can take up to 10 to 15 years, depending upon the amount of people that you have in the study and the kind of disease that you're targeting. But what's the other problem is that amount of time has not gone down. The number of new medications hitting the market has declined since 2008. And we are really hitting we're in a crux now where it's not the science that's limiting us. It's tabloid medicine that is defining what is a safe and what is the risk benefit for each medication.
Yeah, I can't help but notice that 2008 was a presidential election year. There was a transition between 2008 and 2009 to a new administration. are you saying that there's a correlation between the switch in administrations and or do you see a correlation in the switch in administrations and this reduction in the
what I see is a the pendulum started swinging in the wake of Vioxx and the allegations that antidepressants, a form of antidepressants called SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Those are the things in your brain that you regulate to hopefully address the issues of depression or anxiety. The FDA, the bureaucrats, became much more cautious. At a time, ironically, when FDA Commissioner Mark McClellan and Jana Woodcock were developing something called the Critical Path, which basically said, look, let's take the science that's allowing us to individualize the development of drugs and targeting of specific paths or mechanisms for disease, and let's apply it to how we evaluate drugs so that we can reduce the number of people in clinical trials, get things out quicker, and then find out how they work in the real world. A lot of that was put on hold because of the overreaction to the Vioxx and the SSRI situation. And also in 2008, we had the Avandia issue. And I think with the new administration, I think there was an increasing bias towards risk aversion. And it's not just confined to the FDA, but to other agencies as well. So that, you know, we now are in a situation where medications that would that have safer profiles than, say, aspirin or other kind of medications are being set aside because we want more data.
Now, you talk in your book about this antidepressant issue, but you talk about it in the context of suicide. So this notion of tabloid medicine scaring people off antidepressants, you say, has a link to more suicides. Is that how it works?
Sure.
Can you explain that?
Let me give you a broader context. Again, going back to the two studies that CDC came out, life expectancy and death rates for all major diseases declined between 2008 and 2009, except in one category, teen suicide. The rate of teen suicide went up, and the number of teen suicides went up. Now, if you can go to the CDC and you can see they now have very pretty detailed data about what types of medications were used and at what rate. And again, across the board, medications for heart disease, cancer, respiratory issues, uses went up. It declined in depression. So that correlation is pretty strong and has been sustained since the claims that SSRIs cause suicide were spread. And by the way, you know, it's not suicide, it was suicidality, which is a very, very vague term to characterize outbursts of people that are depressed in clinical trials. And even the media initially rarely made the distinction between suicide and suicidality. Headlines were SSRIs linked to suicide. And what's happened is, ironically, yes, it has. The decline in the use of medications has led to an increase in suicide, so that it is now the 10th leading cause of death in the United States.
And it's not just a problem with teens. I mean, it's a problem
yes,
with the U.S. military
yes.
As well.
A huge problem, which I didn't go into the book, but you pointed out that indeed the utilization of these medications in treating people coming back from combat is essential. But they're being misprescribed and underused as a result of this.
Scary stuff. Well, Bob, we're about at the end of our time, but I have a signature question that I like to ask at the end of each one of these New Books in Public Policy podcasts, which is, if you were czar for a day, what would you do? What policies would you initiate that you've learned about or come up with as a result of writing your book?
I think I would make a policy that scientists would have to be much more out in front in discussing the risks and benefits of things more clearly, and do it in a way that is not politically pressured. It's not a grand gesture, but I'm a limited government kind of guy. I think that I would have government agencies and the Congress hold oversight hearings on the unregulated speech that is being passed along in the form of tabloid medicine. People can cry, can say anything they want and get picked up, but no one ever tends to challenge them. And I wouldn't mandate it, of course, but I think we need to have more more engagement with these forces. Otherwise, they're going to continue to redefine things in ways that scare us to death.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, fortunately, you don't need to be czar for a day to do some of those things. I know that you had a book event where you released your book on Capitol Hill, so you must have some ties with the majority in Congress, and you can recommend a hearing where we look at those questions of risks and benefits and explain the notion of how Americans tend to overstate the risks of various medications, but they underestimate the benefits.
Several years ago, I mean, after Three Mile Island, we did just that. We, the president of the United States at the time, commissioned a panel that, was it a guy named Jimmy Carter at the time? I think it may have been. I tend to forget those days. Where Josh Lederberg and many other people looked at how are we communicating risk as a society and as a government, and came to the conclusion that the overstatement of risk had very serious policy and economic consequences. And I think maybe it's time to reestablish that sort of panel. I wouldn't have the IOM do it because I think they're too political. Institute of Medicine. Right. I would probably have a independent commission, maybe even a presidential commission, look at it. Or a congressional commission look at it so that we get a full airing of the people that have been silenced for so long.
Well, I think you've raised some really interesting points. It is an excellent book. It is called Tabloid Medicine, How the Internet is Being Used to Hijack Medical Science for Fear and Profit. The author is expert, PhD, all-around smart guy and fun guy, Bob Goldberg, Robert Goldberg, PhD, and I urge all of you to go out and get it.
Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you for joining us, Bob. We just had a fascinating conversation with my friend Bob Goldberg, the author of Tabloid Medicine. Look for more podcasts on New Books in Public Policy in the weeks ahead. Thank you.